This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, the topic is things you can do to prevent hospital and healthcare-associated infections. My guest is Dr. Marianne McGuckin, a medical expert in infectious disease prevention. She's author of what I consider an outstanding new consumer book. It's entitled The Patient Survival Guide, published by Demos, D-E-M-O-S, Medical Publishing. During the course of the program, I will give you a couple of websites for Dr. McGuckin because I think that will be helpful. But I have done this program primarily because I think it's so very important. I think this is one of the most important topics we've covered on Your Legal Rights during the entire time I've been doing this program, because it involves what you and I can do to help avoid a serious infection and thus have a good hospital experience and apparently out-of-hospital experience if we're facing some kind of surgery. What we'll be talking about should also help us avoid having to bring a medical malpractice case against a hospital. Before I tell you more about Dr. McGuckin, let me just say this. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Also, I want to point out to you that the August edition of Consumer Reports has an outstanding article in it, How Safe is Your Hospital? And I recommend it to you, as I do recommend to you Dr. McGuckin's book. In the article in Consumer Reports, it says, it actually refers to a 2010 report from the Department of Health and Human Services, which states that 180,000 hospital patients die due to infections, surgical mistakes, and other medical harm. And another 1.4 million hospital patients are seriously hurt by their hospital care. And these figures apply only to Medicare patients. Dr. McGuckin has over 35 years of experience as a faculty and staff member of the University of Pennsylvania. She was the lead author for the patient empowerment section of the World Health Organization's Guideline for Hand Hygiene in Healthcare in 2009. In 2002, she served on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Task Force that developed the guidelines for hand hygiene in healthcare settings. Dr. McGuckin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's really nice to have you here. You and I have had a chance to chat before going on the program. I think one of the things that you stress here is that you're trying to help a patient become empowered, and also how incredibly important it is to have an advocate with you, a patient advocate with you, whether you're in the hospital or let's say you're in some place for a surgical operation that may not be in the hospital. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the foundation of empowerment is to understand that no matter what age you are, in your 20s, your 30s, 40s, that you need to identify a person that you're very comfortable with that can serve as your advocate, not in terms of end-of-life experiences, but through your entire healthcare arena of care, whether you're going to have surgery, whether you're going to be hospitalized. You have to be comfortable that this patient can speak for you, can understand or relay to you what someone is saying. So we really have it impressed the fact that this is an important factor in empowerment. And this person, you have to understand, you know, is going to be speaking for you. So that lays the foundation of empowerment. I think it's also important to realize that in the healthcare setting, part of empowerment is not only empowering consumers out there when they become patients, but we also try to empower our healthcare workers, because we know that the single most important thing in making sure that a patient feels comfortable being empowered and asking questions is if healthcare workers give them permission. In other words, invite them to ask questions, to say, we want you to be part of our team.
You know, I think, though, Marianne, a lot of people, and including myself, from time to time, are somewhat, and here I am, I've been a lawyer for a long time, are somewhat intimidated by the whole hospital situation, you know, especially if you're in the ER room. Of course, that's a different than if you are planning to have a surgical procedure done. I think people are intimidated to want to, let's say, to the healthcare worker, the nurse, or even the doctor, or both, have you washed your hands? What can you tell us about this in terms of making us feel more comfortable that we really should do this?
Well, what we know and what's happening in hospitals is hospitals have infection control programs. a big part of an infection control program is to make sure that there is hand hygiene compliance, because we know that often in many hospitals across the U.S., hand hygiene occurs less than 50% of the time. So infection control teams are really on this to increase this compliance. And we have determined that one of the things that healthcare workers are doing is involving their patients. So they're almost expecting patients to be part of their team. And often they will go in and say, you know, we expect you to remind us if you see that we're not practicing hand hygiene, to simply remind us and say, can you please sanitize or wash your hands, or have you washed your hands, or please wash your hands, whatever way you're comfortable doing it. Often hospitals will have in the room, they will have on the TV, the in-circuit TV, they will have a program showing that hand hygiene is important. You can't go in a hospital now without seeing sanitizers on the walls, by the elevators, outside the patient's room. So hospitals are getting on board that it's so important, this hand hygiene.
Is that, are the sanitizers, are they as effective, generally speaking, as someone going to a sink and washing with soap and water?
Yeah, sanitizers are really the method of choice.
Mm-hmm.
They do a better job, and the only time people will use soap and water is if your hands are visibly dirty.
I see.
In other words, if they're stained or something like that. But hand hygiene is an excellent way in which to remove the bacteria from your hands. So it's fine to use that. But patients, you know, they become empowered as soon as they realize that their healthcare member is also empowered and is asking them to be part of their team. And we found in all of our studies that once this starts happening, healthcare workers encouraging patients, we can find that somewhere around 80% of patients will get on board and will begin to ask the simple question, did you wash your hands?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's here or in the U.S. or abroad, we found that this program will win.
I know, and before we went on the air, you mentioned to me that there's a statistic, and that is that healthcare workers between patients wash their hands or use sanitizers less than 50% of the time.
Yes, that's correct. That's what we know. And we actually collect data from many hospitals across the U.S., and we find that it's about less than 50% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is if we healthcare workers are washing their hands less than 50% of the time, and we know that certain bacteria, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, what we call the super resistant organism, superbugs like MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph aureus bacteria, we know that in hospitals at any given time, about 60% of patients can be colonized with this bacteria. That means it's on their skin. It doesn't mean it's causing them an infection, but it's on their skin.
How does it get on their skin?
Well, we know that when patients are in a hospital, often you develop the bacteria that is in the environment.
Is that in the air? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it can be transmitted from one patient to the other, so
uh-huh.
It's on the patient's skin. We also know that patients can come in with this bacteria because mm-hmm. It can be in the community, and what's in your community ends up in your hospital. So if we have a large percentage of patients having this MRSA, compounded by the fact that healthcare workers are washing their hands less than 50% of the time, you can see that this is becoming a global problem. It's an epidemic. And the only way that you get MRSA, these superbugs, is by transmission one patient to the other, and hands serve as a vehicle for transmitting the bacteria.
So it is not something, generally speaking, that you can get, be contacted by it being just in the air.
No, you're not going to breathe
okay,
in MRSA.
All right. I'm glad to hear that.
A likely source is, you know, simply simple as, you know, the bed rails. You know, healthcare
oh,
workers
yes.
come in and touch
sure.
that.
Sure.
If they don't wash their hands, they go to another patient.
Yeah.
And you want to also emphasize the fact that gloves do not replace hand hygiene. If a healthcare worker comes in and you say, did you wash your hands? Can you please sanitize your hands? And mm-hmm. they say, oh, there's no problem. I'm wearing gloves.
Yeah.
That is not the rule. The rule is, before and after you put on gloves, before and after you go near a patient. So there's no easy way that you're putting on gloves, because often healthcare workers putting on the gloves because they feel they're protecting themselves. They're not protecting you.
And so they would be putting on gloves, generally speaking, with some significant percentage, perhaps, without having washed their hands first before pulling on these clean gloves.
Exactly, and they can become contaminated. And we also found that gloves are so readily available. I'm sure your listeners will understand. You go in a hospital room, they're often just like a box on the wall.
Oh, sure.
They'll come in, they'll grab a pair of gloves, and they'll put them on and go over. Well, they missed the important step. It should be they come in your room, sanitize their hands or wash their hands, whichever they prefer. We prefer that they sanitize it, get the gloves, put them on, do whatever they're going to do, take off the gloves, again, sanitize their hands before they leave. Go to the next patient's room and repeat this.
Would you explain this to us, though? If they have sanitized their hands before putting on the gloves, they do their job of working with this patient with the gloves on, they take the gloves off, what goes on with the hands that you're saying they should sanitize their hands at that point again?
Because if by chance when they took off the gloves, there were bacteria on the outside. When they roll the glove off, mm-hmm. they contaminated their hands. Mm-hmm. If they don't sanitize their hands at that time, they're leaving the room. They will be touching the door, going into the next room, and transmitting the bacteria. We have a very good video. I know you were
going to
mention the website on
the website. Oh, sure.
In which we actually show in a given day. It's a hospital, Hershey Medical Center in Pennsylvania, that did a wonderful video showing exactly what I'm describing now, a doc coming in, going to the nurse's station, going to a patient, and they show the transfer of the bacteria. It's an excellent, teaching tool for a patient or a consumer to look at this so that when they do become a patient, they'll have a picture in their mind. Look, this doc is doing this. I need to ask him to sanitize his hands.
So we got to ask, we should, as a practice, in terms of protecting ourselves, if we're in this situation where we're going to have some kind of medical surgical procedure, we should also consider asking the doctor to sanitize his or her hands.
Well, exactly.
Because they're not exempt from this, huh?
Yeah, definitely. And we're on the line of talking about surgeons, not that we're just going down that road, but surgical procedures, when you get a surgical site infection, it has a high risk of mortality and complications. So it's real important that before you're having surgery, obviously if it's not an emergency type procedure, that you get all the facts. And part of the facts is when you go to see your surgeon, you need to ask important questions. And one of the most important questions is, for the last 100 procedures that are similar to the one that I'm going to have, what was your outcome? What was your infection rate? And as I say to people, if a doc says to you, don't worry, there's no problem, you need to find another doc. Mm-hmm. If he says, I don't have infections, you need to find another doc. If he says, I don't know, you need to find out what his rates are. That is so important because we know that people spend less than an hour researching about their doc and their surgery. And there's no reason for that now because laws, including California is one of the states, that there is reporting of healthcare-acquired infections to the State Department. So this data is available through your local Department of Health. You can also, call your hospital and find out. So there are many ways in which you can get this information. And, I always like to say, people say, well, not everyone is computer savvy. Well, if they're not, there's always your local library.
Yes.
That will help you get this information. We realize that a lot of people are not computer savvy. So it's out there, and there's no excuse for you not knowing more about your surgeon before they do the procedure.
One of the things, Marianne, in the Consumer Reports, August edition of Consumer Reports, this article, How Safe is Your Hospital, which I certainly urge people to pick up and read, is that they include about, it looks to me, somewhere in the neighborhood of close to at least 100, maybe a little bit more than 100 hospitals in California. And what they do is they have a column called Safety Score. And you'd be surprised The best safety score out of 100 is 68, and that's the Bakersfield Heart Hospital in Bakersfield. And it goes down from there. And this includes a great number of hospitals, some of which people would be familiar with the name. So I highly recommend for you, wherever you are in California, to pick up that edition. Let me give your websites, because I think this is very important. Dr. Marianne McGuckin has two websites that I'd like you to know about. And first of all, let me repeat the title of her book, which I think is essential. Those of you who listen to this program know that essentially always my guests are lawyers, because we're funded. The program is funded by the State Bar, primarily the State Bar of California. But I felt that this was so important and has a relationship, of course, to potential medical malpractice on the part of hospitals that I felt I just could not pass this up. So the book is entitled The Patient Survival Guide. It's a paperback, which is very interesting, which makes it more reasonable to get in terms of the cost. And it's published by an outfit called Demos, D-E-M-O-S, Medical Publishing. I think if you Google that, you could find out where it was. Let me give you Dr. McGuckin's two websites if you want to jot them down, because I think you should have this available to you. www.hhreports.com. hhreports.com. The other one is www.patientsurvivalguide, just like the title of the book, .net, www.patientsurvivalguide.net, which has a lot of information on it. One of the things I wanted to ask you, and by the way, for those of you who've tuned in the last couple of minutes, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program on what you can do to prevent hospital and healthcare-associated infections. My guest is Dr. Marianne McGuckin. She's a medical expert in infectious disease prevention. One of the things, Marianne, that frankly I think is important for people to also know, which was interesting to me as we were preparing for the program before we went on the air, a lot of surgical procedures are being done outside of the hospital. Can you talk about that a little bit? And if the principles that we're talking about, the cautions that we're talking about, also apply there?
It had been projected, and we're beyond that now, that by the year 2010, about 80% of surgical procedures will be done in what we call these ambulatory surgery centers.
So you go in, it's done, and you leave fairly quickly.
It used to refer to as same-day surgery.
Yeah.
A lot of these are within a hospital structure, but a lot of them are freestanding type ambulatory care centers. We now feel much better about these centers because they now have guidelines. They've come under the umbrella. They're developing good practices in infection control. But prior to that, when they looked at these centers, that one of the biggest deficiencies was in the area of infection control. So, you know, we now need to be just as vigilant. And all of the things that we talk about in the book apply to these ambulatory surgery centers. I mean, it's not that, you know, you only do these things when you're in a hospital. They apply to also those type of centers, like simple things. If you're going to have a procedure that's going to require you to have preoperative antibiotic to prevent an infection, we know that there's a window of time when you should get this, which is usually 0 to 60 minutes. So you need to be aware, or your advocate, that you don't want to be given this antibiotic while you're waiting before you're having the procedure. It should be done within a given period of time.
Mm-hmm. Marianne, why is that? Why should it be done within a certain period of time?
Because you want the load and the most effect of that antibiotic when they're making that incision.
Okay.
You know, antibiotics go in the body, they have a peak in the trough, so they want to, you know, you want to have it there at the site when you're making the incision. So these are important things. One of the things that I always like is very simple. Now, this applies more to an inpatient setting, is after a surgical procedure, many patients will have what we call a catheter, a Foley catheter, to drain the urine because they may not be able to get out of bed. We know that every day a catheter stays in, you have a 3 to 7% chance of getting a urinary tract infection. Often the only reason the catheter isn't coming out is someone has forgotten to write the note on the chart to remove the catheter.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple. You need to ask every day to your nurse, or did someone write to remove this catheter? Do I need it? It just jogs their mind. Gee, I need to go look at the patient's chart and see.
Mm-hmm.
Another important thing that we discuss in the book, and this is for patients in intensive care unit. Again, this is where your advocate comes in, or your loved one who's there. When you go in and you look at someone in intensive care unit, we want to make sure that the back of the bed is at an angle at about 30 degrees, because that can decrease your chances of getting these ventilator-associated pneumonias. Another important thing...
Say that again, because I think this is very, very important. We're talking about respirators and ventilators, and we need these. What's the purpose of us having either or both of those?
Well, to help you breathe.
Okay.
You know, often people will need mechanical ventilation, you know, to help them breathe.
And again, why? And again, what should we be sure that is done in terms of the placement of the bed at the
back, you know, how the back of the bed will go up?
Yes.
You know, you want to make sure it's sort of like at a 30-degree angle.
Mm-hmm.
And often you will go in and you'll see this, but often what happens is healthcare workers are very busy right now, and there's no excuse, but they would appreciate being reminded, look, shouldn't the back of the bed be up a little?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very simple. Also, oral care. When people are in respirators, they have the same bacteria that you and I have. You wouldn't think of going 4 or 5 days without brushing your teeth or washing your mouth. Well, the same thing applies to these patients. They need oral care. And we have found out in studies that have been done that often less than 30% of the time this is being done. So important thing, you go in to see someone in intensive care unit, you just say, you know, has oral care been done? And some hospitals are very understand the importance of this, and they will actually have a sheet on the back of the bed showing oral care, and people will check it and sign it that it's been done. But you need to remember that. The other real important thing that I think more and more consumers are understanding, or patients about this, is if you go see someone in a hospital, a relative, and often relatives have a good indicator that something's wrong. If you see the patient and you feel like, you know, they seem to be doing worse, no one seems to be paying attention,
mm-hmm.
If you first ask the nurse and the doctor and you're not getting attention, hospitals now have, and you'll see it on the wall, they will have a sheet of paper that says they can call it an alert team. Different terms are being used, where you can pick up the phone and you can dial a number, and a team will come to the patient's bedside, evaluate the situation immediately. You know, those days are over where someone will say to you, I can't get anyone now. You'll have
mm-hmm.
to wait.
Mm-hmm.
So if you feel that you're patient or your loved one or whatever is not getting the care that they deserve, you have a right to do this. So,
and this is not just any one of the nurses in the area. It's people who are specially assigned
right.
to do this.
It's a special team that mm-hmm. gets called immediately, and then often mm-hmm. it will be, you know, a doc, a nurse, somebody from administration. They want to solve this thing because, as I said, often you know your family member better than other people, and if you feel they're not getting the care that they should, or there's a problem and you can't resolve it with the team right there as your immediate access, then you need to intervene. And that's empowerment. That's what we're talking about. It's taking the steps that are necessary to prevent a healthcare-acquired infection or any type of medical error. I mean, there's a whole gamma. You know, I focus just on healthcare-associated infections, but there's a whole gamma of medical errors, wrong-type surgery. You know, there's a whole list
mm-hmm.
of them, and it all involves empowerment.
What about in the informed consent form that we're always asked to, and it's rather at least 2 or 3 pages, a small print, that we're asked to read and sign, read, date, and sign. What comments do you have about those?
Well, I think they have to be informative. You know, there are 6 criteria that must be part of the informed consent, and I'm not going to go through the 6 of those, but there are 6 things. The most important things are, do I need this procedure? What is the alternative? What are the risks, the complications? And in that now should be, you know, infection rate. What
mm-hmm,
are
mm-hmm.
the infection rates for this procedure that I'm having? And that's important. And people need to realize, and I'm sure you understand this, that because you signed that informed consent, it doesn't mean that, you know, you can't change your mind. And often people are now at the level and they will write on there that they want only their surgeon to do the procedure, opening and the closing, and they don't want anyone else doing that. And it is your right to put that on the informed consent.
That I only want my own surgeon doing the procedure?
Yeah, that you don't want a resident. Yeah. Certainly if you're going to a teaching hospital, often, you know, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But you need to realize it is your right.
What about the, if you've done some research, which you're telling us that we should do in terms of our empowerment and preparing for going in for a surgical procedure, what if in your research you find out what the infection rate of the hospital has been? Should you also insert that in the informed consent?
Well, I think you can ask. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the things you want to know, and we talk about this in one of the chapters, like something as simple as when you're going to have a baby. They have prenatal classes and they have tours and all this, and people never think to ask questions. Is there an outbreak going on in the nursery?
Yeah.
Is there something? It's almost the same.
Is something going on somewhere else in the hospital, huh?
Right. Is there something that I need to know about the nursery? Are they having a problem there? And because sometimes people do have a choice to go somewhere else. You know, granted, we're driven by what insurance, you know,
of course,
being taken, but sometimes there are options. But informed consent is so important for you to know. And informed consent on some procedures, for instance, sometimes you'll go in for a preoperative procedure. A good example in my mind is gallbladder. They might do a procedure called an ERCP, where they go in and kind of look and see what's going on in the bile duct. Well, often, you know, you never see the doc who's going to do that procedure until the day of the procedure, and you're there in a gown with this informed consent, and they're asking you these questions, you know, like,
pretty scary.
Here you've gotten up 5 o'clock in the morning to have this procedure. You're sitting in this room with a gown, and someone's going to come in with this informed consent form. And are you going to be in a position? Is that informed consent where you're going to be asking, I have an alternative?
Try to avoid that. We have come to the end of the half hour, the statewide version of the program, Marianne. We will continue live in the Bay Area. We continue live on the internet at www.kalw.org. So don't anyone who's with us live go away. All right, it's 7:28, or actually 7:27 and a half, at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. By the way, we will be doing our Call a Lawyer Night next week. The topic is, if you're into social networking and if you're also working in some office, we're going to be doing this aspect of employment law, social networking issues in the workplace. My guests will be Tyler Patko. He's a past chair of the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar, and an associate attorney of his, Olga Savage, and they'll both be here. And then we'll be doing our Call a Lawyer Night. You might want to jot down the number, 1-800-525-9917. For those of you who have a question for my guest, Dr. Marianne McGuckin, the number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. If you'd like to call in with a question, a comment, whatever, I think it'd be really nice to hear from you. Dr. Marianne McGuckin is a medical expert in infectious disease prevention. She's author of the new consumer book. It's a paperback, which makes it reasonable for all of us. It's entitled The Patient Survival Guide. It's published by Demos, D-E-M-O-S, Medical Publishing. A couple of websites for Dr. McGuckin, which you might want to jot down, are www.hhreports.com and www.patientsurvivalguide.net. I also want to bring to your attention that the August issue of Consumer Reports has a very fine article, which actually is entitled, How Safe is Your Hospital? And it actually has a listing of hospitals for California, somewhere in the neighborhood. I think it's at least 100, somewhere around approximately 100 hospitals, where they rate them by safety score. And unfortunately, the best here that I see at the top of the list is, out of 100, it's a 68%. Which doesn't make me feel too terrific about it, but I guess that's not too bad considering that some of them are down to under 50%. Some actually are down to as much as under 30%. And major hospitals in their areas. So if you want to talk to Dr. McGuckin, please join us. And let me do this before we start with questions for her. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. And for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KLW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own. That's 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone experienced for you for a half an hour consultation with the attorney. And the cost, depending on the county, will, for a half an hour, may be a low of $25 or a high of $35. You're probably wondering, why is Chuck having a medical program on your legal rights? Well, you know, when I first started as a broadcaster, I did it, believe it or not, even I think before Dr. Dean Edel, all of you probably know that name, I had a health program. And it was a weekly program. And actually, I was awarded an award by the American Heart Association in San Francisco for doing that. And then I decided that I wanted to convince the State Bar of California to do a legal program. Now, the reason and the justification that I can do for this program, is that, one, this is so important in terms of empowering us in terms of, are we going to go and have some kind of surgical procedure either in or outside of the hospital? I think this is terribly important. But it also relates to the legal potential of, if we get an infection or something goes wrong in the hospital or outside of the hospital with a surgical procedure, we don't want to end up having a medical malpractice lawsuit that we want to bring. So there you are. That's why I'm doing it. So, Dr. McGuckin, welcome back to the program, and let's start with Karen. Karen, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, thank you very much, Chuck. I think this is a great program. I think you ought to have it on once a month. Medical is always a very big issue.
It is, no question.
A couple of questions. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Number one, what are the ingredients of this hand sanitizer?
Hmm. Okay.
Everyone's got to be sanitizing. You see it outside the supermarkets. Mm-hmm. Everyone is sanitizing. Is it purely chemical? And if so, is that going into the skin of the doctors and the nurses and anybody else?
Okay, stop for a moment, Karen. Let me get Dr. McGuckin to respond to that. Marianne, do you have any idea what's
Karen.
In those? Yeah, go ahead.
Most of them have an alcohol-type base, and other ingredients are in them to make them feel nice. But it's primarily an alcohol-type product. And I agree with you, Karen. You know, there's a place for these. We have gone totally extreme.
Yes.
You know, you'll find that little kids will have these, you know, sanitizers in their backpack. And, you know, I think, you know, in the right place, they serve their purpose. They work. The alcohol is excellent against, you know, bacteria, the sanitizers. We know there's a tremendous effect, you know, in the healthcare setting. But is it necessary for people to be walking around the way they are with the sanitizers? I'm not sure, because obviously, you know, there can be problems with them. And the key thing that people need to realize, if you're going to get rid of bacteria, the key thing that gets rid of bacteria on the skin is friction. So,
right.
You know, we always say to people, you know, and people, they did a huge study in Germany many years ago in schools where before kids went to lunch, they just gave them a paper towel.
Ah.
Right. Good. Thank you so much. I have one other question.
Yes.
Okay, this is about catheters. You talked about the fact that maybe one of the orderlies or the nurses or somebody on the floor, and I've been a patient in hospitals a number of times, just forgot to write the note to remove your catheter, so that we should be responsible for asking on a daily basis, are we supposed to have our catheter in? Is there supposed to be a note to take the catheter out? Which is actually, if you've had surgery and you're on heavy medication and you can barely move, mm-hmm. if you're in pain, how are you going to remember, how am I going to remember, yeah. that I have to, on a daily basis, check up on these nurses who don't want to be slapped with a malpractice suit, mm-hmm. and ask them, oh, did you remember to write the note on my chart to remove my catheter?
Okay, well, let me know about that.
Karen, take the answer on the air, will you, Karen? Thank you very much for your two very good questions. Go ahead.
Let me just clarify. You know, it's not the nurse and the orderly who are going to be writing it. It's going to be your primary care doc. And in some situations, you know, they will come in, like, once a day. And it's important, you know, that some way be presented to them that they know they have to write. If you are in pain and you're that debilitated and all, there's a good probability you need that catheter because you're not going to be mobile. I'm talking about situations where you really don't need it because you're better, you can get up, you are mobile. And often, you know, the nurse or the orderly can come in and just take it out without a written order. So that's the important thing. You know, your advocate or you, just, you know, a reminder. Each day I have a catheter. Can the catheter, you know, come out?
If someone, though, has not recovered to the point where they are able to get out of the hospital bed, mm-hmm. is a general practice with the catheter to leave it in, or is it a general practice to take it out and replace it with a clean catheter, or is there any particular procedure that one can expect?
If you need a catheter, there's what we call catheter care, mm-hmm. but the rule is not to be taking it in and out because each mm-hmm. time, you know, you're going to introduce bacteria.
Yes.
The important thing is also when they drain the catheter, you know, you want to make sure that it gets drained down, that they're not lifting the tube up so that there's a chance of bacteria to go into you. So there's all these mm-hmm. things that we actually describe in the book, mm-hmm. but, I mean, the simplest thing is making sure the best way to avoid, we always say, and we say this in the book, and the best way to avoid a urinary tract infection is to not have a catheter.
Okay. And also, I think in terms of Karen's second question, this is where certainly if you have chosen to have an advocate with you, which you're telling us we should, the advocate could be there if the person is certainly not in a position to know what's going on. The person's in the bed. Certainly the advocate is there, hopefully, who will ask some simple questions and hopefully get some decent answers. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. My guest is Dr. Marianne McGuckin, a medical expert in infectious disease prevention. She's author of an excellent book, which I feel is important that you take a look at, and frankly, I feel I'm a real advocate of one taking control. The whole point of Dr. McGuckin's book is empowerment to the patient. The title is The Patient for Survival Guide. It's published by Demos Medical Publishing, DEMOS Medical Publishing. The number here, 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. And let's talk with David. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Dr. McGuckin, thank you so much for being an advocate for patient safety. I really appreciate this program as well. Can you speak to the ability and venues for both patients as well as healthcare professionals to report preventable medical error issues that they find and the effectiveness of such reporting?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll take my answer.
That's a really great question. Thank you, David, for that question.
Okay, so in general, you know, he's now getting out of the realm of healthcare associated infections, even though they're umbrellaed under mm-hmm. Medical errors. I guess, you know, he's referring to, you know, individual policies within hospitals and whether there's punitive effect on people for reporting these, you know, adverse events or near events. And there are situations in hospitals where they have these programs set up and it's expected that, you know, there's going to be the ability of healthcare workers to report these adverse events without any harm to them or without any punishment.
What about, though, if you are someone, let's say other than a healthcare worker or even a healthcare worker who has observed some practice that obviously is creating a potential hazard to a patient or the hospital generally? Is there, generally speaking, some governmental agency to which either a healthcare worker or a patient or an advocate can file a complaint?
Right. Well, healthcare workers, you know, there's usually a process in their hospital for going through and reporting these adverse. If you are a patient and, or if you are a visitor or a relative and you see something going on that you think is incorrect, you know, I believe the first line is to bring it to the attention to the person that is doing it. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, then you should, in fact, go to either administration in the hospital or the medical director's office and I don't want to say file a complaint, but bring this to their intention. Mm-hmm. And the best way to do this is in writing.
Mm-hmm.
You want to document this, and, you know, it will get some attention because, you know, you realize now we're into this era of happy patients and good satisfaction with the new Medicare rules that payment is going to be based on often patient satisfaction, and now hospitals do. So patients are, hospitals are, want to do a really good job in terms of making their patients happy and satisfied because it's going to affect their payments. With some of the new regs coming out, and to the fact that, you know, this is probably very lighthearted, but some hospitals are actually sending healthcare workers down to the school that they have in Disney World, where they train the employees of Disney World, because you notice everyone who goes to Disney World is very happy, everyone is very joyous, so they're looking at that model because they want healthcare workers to almost see their patients as consumers, and they want to do the best to give them the best care.
I'm astounded to hear this. You're saying in Disney World there is some kind of training program to help you be happy?
Well, not be happy. They're employees. They go through this training program on how to serve the public, how to best...
And so they are now at Disney World. They are inviting and training people who are in the healthcare system?
Right, who are delivering...
That's wonderful.
You know, care. And, you know, why not?
That's wonderful.
We want to be able to...
When did they, Marianne, when did they start this?
I guess the first was about maybe a year or so
no
ago.
No fooling. This is wonderful.
In the news.
Goodness, that's great to hear. I'm glad they're doing that. Gee, sounds wonderful. All right, it's 1-415-841-4134. Dr. McGuckin's websites again are www.hhreports.com, www.patientsurvivalguide.net. That's the same title as her book. And John, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello there, doctor. First of all, might have to debunk your comment there about Disneyland, Disney World employees.
No, it wasn't Disneyland. It was Disney World.
Disney World, okay.
Well, in either case, the Disney company has many very disgruntled employees. I know that from belonging to the union, which provides service.
No kidding. Oh, dear. Well, that's not good. Nobody's totally happy. But go ahead. What's your question, John?
Just curious what your recommendations are or how important you think it is. I suspect that a relative that who came to obviously many difficulties of liver transplant hospital situation may well have contracted MRSA, which finally did him in.
How
important and what are the procedures or protocol to demand, I guess, an autopsy because we were pretty much talked out of it.
So you're saying your relative died from this superbug?
I suspect that.
Ah,
you know, they basically told us, well, obviously, you know, all of these complications from the liver transplant finally, you know, took his life.
Was this somewhere in California, John?
Yes, this was in Southern California, and the hospital was, it was a second hospital that we transferred him to because we thought he was, although doing okay at the main hospital where the surgery was, It was 150 miles away, and he didn't have anybody to visit him for long periods
of
time.
So you moved him, okay.
And so he was going down mentally, so we figured, let's move him closer.
Yeah.
This hospital that was closer was not up on their cleanliness as far as we could see.
Don't give me the name of the hospital. What city did you move him to?
Well, we moved him from UCLA hospital to a San Diego
area hospital. All right. Marianne, can you give John some response to his question?
Yeah. Well, you know, someone who has a liver transplant, you know, often their immune system obviously is affected.
Yeah.
And you know, that doesn't mean that he should have gotten MRSA. On the other side of the coin, we know that not all hospital-acquired infections are preventable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has to be the right place, the right time. And, you know, what you need to do in this situation is, you know, to make you feel better. Unfortunately, they didn't do an autopsy, so you wouldn't have that information. But, you know, the question that you might want to just find out from the hospital, you know, in which he died or the one he was transferred from, because you don't know if, in fact, it was healthcare acquired, which hospital he had this infection is, you want to find out if they're having any problem or any cluster or any outbreak of MRSA in either of those situations during the same time frame as your, you know, relative. I mean, I think that, you know, looking at that, if you come away with the fact, okay, there's not any real problem going on, then unfortunately, you know, he may have been, he's one of those infections that could not have been, you know, prevented.
Mm-hmm. Have you tried contacting either hospital, John, to find out if they did have any cluster of MRSA?
I'm sorry, I was asked a question when you asked.
Let me pose it again. John, have you or any one of your relatives contacted either or both of those hospitals to find out if there, at the time your relative was there, there were any clusters of MRSA?
No, we have not. Would they keep records of that, that they would divulge?
I think that's what Dr. McGuckin is saying. They would, yes.
Yes, I mean, you can ask, you know, for that, and yes, they would keep records of it, because California is one of the states that reports infections to the department, and part of the infection...
The Department of Health, is that, when you say the department, you mean the Department of Health Services?
Right.
Okay.
And part of the infection that they report, they also report their incidence of MRSA.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that information is available. You may, in fact, be able to find out. Often the department, state departments, are not up to date, you know, with their reports. So I would just go to the particular hospital and try to get this information.
Also, John, I'd like to recommend to you, if you haven't done it yet, picking up the August edition of Consumer Reports, which has done a very extensive investigation in terms of hospitals and safety records, etc. It may give you some additional information that will help you in following through on this and satisfying you. So thanks very much.
Real quickly, Dr. So would you say, if you're not comfortable with the rationale for the death of the relative, to go ahead and demand an autopsy, because we were pretty much talked out of it?
Well, you know, I really am not qualified to address, you know, why you were talked out of the autopsy. You know, I don't know all the details, so I really can't comment on that aspect of it.
Do you think, with respect to John's question, do you think that this is something that he should contact an attorney about, in terms of an attorney who may do medical malpractice cases, to get some insight in that?
I think my first line would be to go to each of those hospitals and see what kind of information you can get from them before you leap into the arena, and only because hospitals have that information, and it may be just simply, you know, a discussion of, okay, this is the situation, and this is what happened. And I actually had another case. It was a woman, and I talk about her in the book. She went, and she was from the California area. She went like 2 years thinking that she was responsible for her mom's death because she didn't get her to the ER quick enough after she had a surgical procedure. And she, when she finally got to the ER, she was with her mom. Her mom was dead in about 10 hours. And she felt that she was responsible. And when I talked to her, I said, you know, the most important thing now, in that case, they had done an autopsy. Mm-hmm. I said, the most important thing is, I said, did you get the autopsy report? And she had never gotten it. So it's useless to do this if they're not going to share the information. I told her how to go about and get the report. She got the report. And as I discuss in the book, she then found out that her mom actually did die of an MRSA infection. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But she spent like 2 to 3 years of her life, you know, being guilty that she was the one.
She was the one. Yeah.
So, but she went back to her hospital and she, you know, dealt through that system. And even through that, she didn't end up going to the court. You know, she needed mm-hmm. resolution that this is what has happened. And the hospital worked with her in developing a program so this wouldn't happen in the future.
Thank you, John, very much for your call. All right, let's see. We've got Katie. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Thank you for the program. I'm a healthcare worker myself. So,
mm-hmm.
Two questions. I have one about the alert team being available at night or off hours.
Mm-hmm.
And if it must be a relatively new thing. I had a bad episode with my mother about 3 years ago and basically had the on-call doctor say he wasn't going to come in and deal with it at all. And it was a private hospital, and the docs, they didn't have a hospitalist available. So if a physician was going to come in and talk to her or look at her, he would have had to come in from home. So I don't know if all of that
is now the way the alert teams are working, Marianne. Are they available on a 24-hour basis or only in a certain restricted time period?
It's my understanding that they are available. That's the whole point. And also, mm-hmm. you know, it's part of Joint Commission addresses this in their recommendations about this program being in hospitals. So,
when you say the Joint Commission, what commission is this?
The Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals.
I see. This is a national commission?
Yeah, which they make recommendations.
They have recommendations
and guidelines. It's my understanding that that's the whole idea mm-hmm. of this type of team when there's no one around or there's a problem. Because, and again, it seems that the questions we're getting, we also address in the book. There is another case in the book where we talk about the exact same thing, where this woman was, her dad was pneumonia and she couldn't get anyone, and it was a weekend. Mm-hmm. And by the time the docs came in, it was too late.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and that was before they had this whole idea.
When basically did the alert team concept get going?
I'm saying, and don't hold me for this, probably in the last 3 years or so.
So, yeah.
It's a relatively new type idea that, mm-hmm. you know, you want to avoid these near misses, these mishaps, and by being preventive. And I think it's an excellent thing for hospitals to have. And they're embracing this. Hospitals are embracing this. They don't see this as a negative thing.
And by embracing it, by doing this, I think what they're doing is they're protecting themselves from potential malpractice actions if they didn't. Katie, thank you very much for calling.
I've got one more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, it's probably a bigger one, and that's dealing with the insurance companies. So let's say you have to have your procedure done, and you look up their stats, and they have really lousy stats about the infection rates.
Katie, could I ask you to stop for a minute? Could you ask the person behind you to stop talking?
I'm sorry. If you need to have a procedure done, and the hospital, you've talked to your insurance, and you're going to end up having it at a hospital close by that has these lousy insurance rates, or not insurance, but infection rates, then if you want to go to a different hospital, how much does the insurance company dictate that?
Mm, good point. Excellent point.
Where does the insurance company come if they restrict your ability to go to a different hospital?
Very good point. What comments do you have about that, Marianne?
I was going to turn that one over to you.
I don't have an answer for you, Katie, on that. I don't know. I
guess one of the things that you can address when the insurance company, you know, often, you know, I don't know the hospital system, you know, of that's taking your insurance. You know, sometimes they have multiple hospitals within the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's something to check.
They should have. They certainly should have. I don't have a comment on that, Katie, because I do not get involved in medical malpractice being a deputy DA. I think if that is a critical issue that you need to find out about, where are you? What city are you in?
Oakland.
Are you? You know, if that is something really critical that obviously is bothering you, my suggestion would be for you to think about possibly contacting the Alameda County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service and see if you can find out someone, if they can set you up with someone who does medical malpractice, representing, of course, the patients or the families of patients for a half an hour. And it probably will only cost $35 if this is something really bothering you. Thank you very much for calling. Bye-bye. All right. This is Your Legal Rights. We have, unfortunately, only about 3 minutes left with Dr. McGuckin. Her book is the, quote, The Patient Survival Guide, published by Demos Medical Publishing. Her two websites are www.hhreports.com, www.patientsurvivalguide.net. Let's take one more call. It's got to be relatively brief. I hope I don't ruin the pronunciation of your name. Soncarle, is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, go ahead, briefly, if you would.
Okay. Well, when I had a surgery, and they put a plate in my back, mm-hmm. and the doctor went and took the plate out.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to taking the plate out, the other doctor said, I have a L3 and 4 problem, which has compounded and then causing my hip to be slightly, unbalanced. So this information wasn't shared with me. Are you there?
Yeah, we're here, but okay. you've got to get to the point.
The information wasn't shared with me when I went to see the doctor. He referred me to. They didn't share with me, and then the lawyer didn't tell me. But I settled my case, and then I had all this problem, and then I went to another hospital, and what the other doctor said, and that's exactly what this other doctor found out, and my case already been settled. My medical is open, but the doctor that did the surgery don't want to talk to me.
Well, let me do this. This is a complicated matter. You have an attorney representing you?
I have an attorney, but he's mm-hmm. not working with me, clearly.
All right. I do recommend this, Soncarle, that I think you need to contact the Bar Association in your area, lawyer referral. I think you need to make an appointment to meet with an attorney who does medical malpractice. And I think you need to do some homework. You need to probably meet with more than one attorney. I'm sorry, we have run out of time on the program at this point. Dr. Marianne McGuckin, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. And I really enjoyed the opportunity to share information on this important topic with your listeners.
It's been very, very nice to have you here. By the way, everybody, next week we will do Call a Lawyer Night. The topic on the air will be employment law, focusing on social networking issues in the workplace. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Debbie Kennedy. Debbie, nice to have you with us. Production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Trusts and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Dr. Marianne McGuckin has put together a great book. It's, quote, The Patient Survival Guide, published by Demos Medical Publishing. Also, there's a very fine article this month in the August edition, actually, of Consumer Reports that I suggest that you take a look at. Both of these are excellent resources, and I think you should take a look at them. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Chuck Finney.